Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to another New Energy Chinwag with myself, John Massey, and Charlie Ratton up in the north of England.
Waiting for a heat wave
up there as well.
it's the English summertime, John, so it's nice and cool.
It's going to be 30 down here, apparently, for the next few days. Anyway, there we go. By the by, energy. There you go. Lots of solar energy. But today there was a topic I think you wanted to bring up, Charlie. So maybe if you do the intro on the topic.
Yeah, it's obviously we've talked. I think this is our 35th, 36th Chinwag, John, listeners. And I thought it might be worth a little bit worth exploring a little bit more detail on. We talked about hydrogen in about half a dozen or so of our Chinwags. But one strand of hydrogen that I thought might be interested is the transportation side of it. People are talking about the hydrogen economy, and how do we move it, and how do we get electricity, which is in the form of an electron, to hydrogen, which is in the form of a molecule. And one substance, to use your phrase that has been around for yonks, is ammonia. I've written the odd article or two and published them, and I've been really astonished the response out there when I publish something on hydrogen and ammonia. So I thought it might merit perhaps a chinwag in its own right to see why it's got such a remarkable response, where we are with it, and why it might fit in with a hydrogen and a hydrogen economy. So that's my rationale, John, if you like, for bringing the subject to our listeners' attention today.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I would have a probably slightly different initial take on it. I mean, ammonia is one of the applications of hydrogen. We use hydrogen to make ammonia, and it's a big market. I mean, it's one of the two big uses of hydrogen at the moment. So I guess my interest in ammonia, certainly in the short run, would be, from a hydrogen point of view, would be very much how do we decarbonize ammonia production, because at the moment it's a big source of emissions, big chunk of natural gas usage. I mean, it's about something like 3 or 4% of total natural gas usage goes into producing ammonia. It's some staggering amount. So obviously if we can decarbonize that, it's a kind of ready-made market. It's something that needs decarbonising just to produce the ammonia in the first place, and to use ammonia for all the other things we use ammonia for, chemical feedstock, fertilisers, refrigerants, various other bits and pieces. I mean, the transport side, people have talked about producing ammonia, then transporting it, and then cracking hydrogen back out of ammonia. I mean, there's all sorts of issues with that, not least the inefficiencies involved at both ends. So it'd be interesting to, I mean, get your view on it. But I mean, to me, that seems a lot further away. Over large distances, the inefficiencies seem to outweigh the kind of advantages.
A lot in your answer there. Great, very detailed answer, and it's pulled together two or three strands of thinking at this end. I suppose the basics that you covered there were, what is ammonia, what's it used for? And I think you mentioned fertilizer. So it's got a great agricultural importance already. I didn't realize it was quite so high on the methane usage already. But I suppose if you were to take a more dispassionate view, we've talked in the past about circular economic principles, and now they are helping to guide the energy transition. So I suppose the first question is, I mean, if you're to look at the existing ammonia production, right, we've talked about oil and gas in the past, haven't we, and how that, as a fossil, needs to decarbonize. So the first part of the jigsaw, if you like, is how to decarbonize ammonia production itself. I think in the Cheshire area, I think there's already existing fertilizer production, and they're venting hydrogen, which seems very counterintuitive in the days. I think if you were to be cynical about it, you were saying, I think Manchester Fuel Cell Innovation Centre, about 30 miles away from Merseyside, is spending a lot of money to get perhaps 5 kilograms of hydrogen per day, and yet 30 miles down the road they're venting it by the ton. So I suppose there's a commercial argument in there, and saying, well, look, if we were to try and use this hydrogen and use it for some other purpose, possibly feed it back in circular principles into the production of ammonia, you'd have to present a business case. And I suspect that's why it's not happened to date. Probably people have looked at it and thought, oh my word, it's not very efficient, which is, it's very interesting. We get that a lot in the hydrogen world. Why would you do that when you're putting more energy in to take out, and it costs a lot of money, and the figures don't stack up. But perhaps it's worth revisiting those figures. Electrolyzer costs have fallen. We've talked about offshore renewable, certainly offshore wind. The last auction round, it's come below £40 per megawatt hour. And of course, we've signed up to some pretty ambitious, both national, international, and regional. I think Manchester, for example, has got net zero by 2038, Liverpool by 2040. So it seems therefore counterintuitive to be venting hydrogen, the kind of glamour boy, if you like, of the energy world at the moment, by the ton, whilst 30 miles down the road you're trying to create it at great cost. So that's the backdrop to it. And I think you've mentioned a few things as to why it's not happened. You know, this idea of using something inefficient, I mean, that seems to baffle a lot of people in the certainly from the technical side, certainly from the nuclear world. It's one that you often encounter in the debates. Why would you use hydrogen when it's not that efficient? Can you cast any light on that?
Well, I mean, there's different. You've got to be careful with what you talk, whether you're talking about different things. I mean, looking at production of ammonia. Firstly, I mean, that is starting to happen. I think we'll definitely see green hydrogen being used in production of ammonia rather than hydrogen derived from natural gas. There was a project announced, I think it was just last week or the week before, in Spain, an Iberdrola one, and I can't remember the name of the ammonia production company, but they're building I think it's 20 megawatt electrolyzer, which is supposed to be operational, I think, towards the back end of next year, 2021, which will be using it's a solar farm, a bit of battery storage, and an electrolyzer to produce green hydrogen, and then that will feed into the ammonia production process, and it will replace. I mean, even at that scale, I think even the 20 megawatt electrolyzer, which, if it's built on that time scale, will be one of the biggest in the world. I think even then, it's replacing 10% of their gas usage in the ammonia production process. I think that's a sign that it will happen. They've also made it very clear they're not making any money on that process at the moment. As with all these things, I mean, it's a precursor for decarbonising the process going forwards. It's kind of anticipating, I guess, policy carbon prices and things that will, certainly in Europe, I would imagine, force ammonia production to go clean. So in that sense, the kind of the economics is really down to whether you can do electrolytic hydrogen as cheaply as natural gas hydrogen, given both technology costs and also things like carbon prices and so on. And policy certainly is going to, I think, force people down the process of producing, if you like, green ammonia by using non-fossil hydrogen to do that. So I think there's evidence that kind of thing will happen. The efficiency side, that becomes an issue when if you're talking about transporting. There was another big project, wasn't there, in a bit more kind of notional, I would say, because further away, there was the one in Saudi Arabia where they were talking about something like 4 gigawatts or 5 gigawatts of solar and wind. And again, that was feeding into producing ammonia. But they were talking about, I think, then transporting ammonia to some as yet undecided parts of the world where it would then be split back into hydrogen, because you've got to extract the hydrogen again at the other end, and then used in transport. I mean, again, I think that was, they were talking about 2025, so that's a bit more notional anyway. That's where the efficiency comes in. Is the question is, do you, there's losses involved in producing the ammonia from hydrogen in the first place, and then there's more losses at the other end cracking hydrogen back out of ammonia. Efficiency ultimately is going to relate to the economics. It's whether economically you've used up so much energy doing the round trip that it's still cost effective compared to other options.
Yeah, a lot in there. Again, I talk to a lot of people in the energy world, and especially from a nuclear background, they look at the capacity factors and so forth and the efficiencies, and they think that's the only factor or the only variable for a business case. But I sometimes say, well, look, you know, you're driving, we've driven internal combustion engines for 100 years, they've had an industry, and they're not particularly efficient. So I suppose the bigger picture, as long as the wider business case stacks up, and you might, well, it helps decarbonize, it helps get hard to reach places, it perhaps enables other industries to couple, enables them to offer them a route to net zero. And often they don't see that. They're so kind of focused on one technological aspect of what is a project that they don't see sometimes a wider picture.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned that's why I said it was about the economics, and it's the economics compared to something else. Lower efficiency matters if you're much less efficient than another way of doing the same thing, then you have to have some other economic advantage that's going to overcome that. I mean, that's the nub of the problem. It's certainly not just efficiency. It's how efficiency leads into economics, really, that's going to make the difference.
And that remark that you said about I think you mentioned a project in Spain where it didn't quite stack up. That seems like, if you've been a bit cynical about an argument for some kind of support, be it a subsidy or some kind of tax break or some kind of disguised support that might be buried in the background. Hey, we're keen to do this. We're keen to do everything that you want us to do, but we can't make it add up yet. We might be able to scale up.
I mean, I think that's very much a case of two big companies with deep enough pockets that they can afford to do it without it being a profitable project, in anticipation really of cost reductions from hydrogen production, and also potentially combine that with some policy support in terms of kind of mandates or carbon rules that mean you have to start, you can't just keep producing ammonia and other things, steel, whatever else it may be, from and emitting huge amounts. So they're anticipating both cost reduction and carbon policy, which kind of will tilt the playing field ultimately.
One thing we both do is we track the minutiae of the industry pretty closely, so that our listeners perhaps don't have to. But one thing I did do, immersed in the industry, is I tracked the progress. I think it was an Australian researcher working on ammonia in a little backwater somewhere, not being paid much attention outside the world of academe. But then suddenly I tracked him across, and now he's heading up a team for a pretty major European manufacturer, and I suspect that reason is that somebody's now tacked on to the wider picture of ammonia. And perhaps the real reason I wanted to try and talk with our listeners today about ammonia is not just about the ammonia production itself, but the role of ammonia as a facilitator. We know that a lot of people consider that hydrogen as a fuel, which it's not. It's more accurate perhaps to call it a carrier, but I suspect that bizarrely might also be a plus point, if you like, for ammonia. One quirk is that if you combine hydrogen with ammonia, you can actually move more hydrogen around than hydrogen on its own. And that seems absolutely counterintuitive. People with better chemical knowledge than I can perhaps explain why that is. I've seen various diagrams of molecules and so forth. But if you combine hydrogen and ammonia, you can shift it. And when people are talking about these grandiose hydrogen strategies, even since we last talked about it, which wasn't long ago, there's been a German hydrogen strategy, a European hydrogen strategy, a Spanish hydrogen, Portugal, everybody's coming out with these strategies and roadmaps. But one quirk, again, another quirk, is that sometimes the hydrogen can be produced, perhaps in the North Sea, and this is notional, a long way away from where manufacturing industry might require it. If we think about Germany, where the car manufacturers might be based in places like Munich and Stuttgart, that's a long way. It's on the complete other end of the country from where some of these schemes in the North Sea, we've got schemes like Westcuster and Crosswind, Gigastack, they all contain hydrogen elements, but that hydrogen has to be moved or transported to where the industry requires it, not just population, but also industry as well. And I suppose that is where my interest in ammonia as a transport facilitator emerges. Could ammonia be a missing link on a missing link? If people are thinking that hydrogen itself is a missing link, it might be a missing link between gas and air being wind and gas being hydrogen rather than methane. But is there another? Could we liquefy it? Could we transport it as ammonia, which is it's not the most exciting substance, but it's known about. People know how to handle it. It's not without its issues, but it's nothing scarier than is already dealt with. Could we transfer it? I think you mentioned this idea of putting it into another format and then cracking out at each end. And even with the inefficiencies of that, it might still offer a route to net zero. What are your thoughts on that hypothesis?
Yeah, I mean the principle around using ammonia as a carrier is that, well, there's a couple of things compared to just transporting hydrogen on its own. I mean, if you're going to transport a lot of something a long way, then energy density becomes important, i.e. you've got to be able to, and I'm talking volumetric energy density, you've got to be able to get enough of it into a boat to transport a reasonable quantity. And ammonia, there's two things about ammonia compared to hydrogen. For hydrogen, the densest you can make it is to liquefy it, but that involves temperatures of minus 253 degrees centigrade or something ridiculous. Whereas ammonia, you only have to liquefy to, I think it's minus 33 is the boiling point of ammonia. So there's much less kind of refrigeration and so on involved. And also the kind of volumetric energy density of ammonia, liquid ammonia, is better than liquid hydrogen. So you could get, effectively you get that, I mean, that's back to your statement. If I had a boat of a certain volume, I could get more hydrogen on it in the form of ammonia than I could in the form of hydrogen. I guess it's sort of the NH, you've got NH3 rather than just H2. I don't know, that's probably a rather simplistic thing. But so there's the energy density, and there's also the less cryogenic, low temperature stuff you need to do. I think I would say, again, I think we've got to separate out the production, the transport, and the end usage. So, for example, that if we look at our Spanish ammonia plant, or we look at a German ammonia plant, or wherever else we've got ammonia plant, it would be perfectly, I mean, another, if you're relying on imports on a large scale, for example, let's say now we're not producing hydrogen in Spain, we're producing it in Morocco or somewhere where, because there's massive cheap sunshine and we can produce lots of low-cost hydrogen, what you'd be looking at there is potentially the economics of converting it to ammonia, putting it on a boat and transporting it thousands of miles to Europe. But then at the other end, you've kind of got choices. And the more obvious one to me, certainly in the short run, given that we've got this big ammonia industry, industry that uses ammonia as a feedstock, would be, rather than convert it back to hydrogen at the other end, why not use it as ammonia at the other end? So you could still use ammonia as a, you're using it as a transport carrier, if you like, but you're just taking out the return path, if you like, because that's where you'd have to be. If you're, I think the return, it's something like 75% efficiency to crack ammonia, because you've got to put energy in to get the hydrogen back out again. So that's quite a lot of energy. That's quite a lot of your energy content to lose to go back to hydrogen at the other end. So I think over short distances, things like pipelines are just going to make much more sense. But over long kind of intercontinental differences, that's where we're back to the economics. The ability to transport more in a smaller vessel or in a bigger vessel, to just transport more stuff, would have to outweigh the losses at either end. But as I say, it doesn't need, with ammonia, I don't think it needs to be a two-way process. You could produce green hydrogen in one place, convert it to ammonia, transport ammonia, and then use it as ammonia at the other end, because there's a massive ammonia in this, end-use industry that exists anyway that needs decarbonising.
Yeah, it's funny because the company I mentioned, which is an extremely well-known German company, well-known for its electrical products, is saying that just that in a slightly eyebrow-raising moment. It announced, we are now entering the fertiliser market. So you might raise why somebody with 100 years of electrical experience suddenly setting itself out in the agricultural sector. But from what you're saying there might be actually a very good reason for doing that. It'll give them control, and it'll give them the ability to choose whether or not to go through the second stage of an already not particularly efficient process. But if they say, well, there's an alternative market, we can hedge, if you like, and whichever is most economic for our business case, then we'll choose to go down that route. Smart move in some respects.
Yeah, I think the other thing to say on the efficiency side is I think it partly, again, I can't claim to be an expert on the processes. I know the to combine the two together, I think there's quite a coming which way around. One, at one end, you've got to input a lot of heat, and the other end involves a lot of heat coming out of the process. And so, where again, it might, one thing that would overcome some of the the kind of efficiency issues was if there was either a source of heat at the end, you needed a source of heat, and then a usage of heat at the end where heat was being emitted. So, I mean, that would lend itself, for example, to things like industrial clusters, a bit back to your sector coupling thing. So one way to overcome things like efficiency, because mostly when people talk about inefficiency, they're often talking about heat losses. And so one way to, for the economics of that to be improved is not to treat heat losses as heat losses, but to treat them as, here's a source of heat that you can actually use in another process. So in effect, you're getting more out of the energy that you're carrying. So, and that sort of ties in with the whole kind of industrial kind of port strategy, if you like. You'd have ships at one end, maybe producing ammonia from clean hydrogen, and involving tied in with industrial processes around heat usage, and at the other end the reverse, if you like, producing getting hydrogen back out of the ammonia, and again tied in with industrial processes where the heat transfer was, could be part of those processes. So that will be another I mean, that's another counter argument to some of the issues around efficiency. A lot of it comes down to, can you tie these things in with other heat related processes? And that, yeah. and often at ports, as we're seeing, ports and industrial clusters tend to go together. So it's certainly not impossible that you could have those kind of synergies going on.
Yeah, in fact, we talked about clusters, didn't we, a few weeks ago on a podcast, and we looked at the pros and cons and the various reasons why clustering might be a good idea. Certainly, we've seen it deployed to some considerable extent in the offshore wind industry in the UK. We've both been to cities like Hull and places like Grimsby, which clustering has certainly proved effective. And lo and behold, in the UK, I think for the hydrogen economy, part of its carbon capture and storage, which we've talked about, but the clustering, I think there are 8 major clusters being mooted for the UK, ranging from the east of England to South Wales to our own northwest and beyond. And from what you're saying, you can see that they're actually good. If you were to think of a heat intensive industry, I don't know whether that would extend to steel making or something like that, which is also being mentioned in the hydrogen world, but you can see actually it's a case of using the resources that we've got in the most efficient manner that you can. I mean, I suppose combined heat and power has been around a long time. Also, LNG has been around a while as well. So if you're looking at the transportation of ammonia, would you be looking at the LNG vessels and the way that works as a mechanism to get the liquid as you, to where you need it?
Yeah. See, I mean, it's exactly that kind of analogy. I mean, combined heat and power is a good analogy, because you can look at thermal power generation and say, well, that's horribly inefficient, but it's horribly inefficient if you only look at the power bit of it. If you use the heat, then it can be 90% efficient in terms of what is in the fuel that arrives and what energy you use at the other end. It's just that we tend to focus on just using the electricity bit of it, and the heat kind of drifts up into the, through the cooling towers into the sky. But if we use the heat, then we're getting much more out of the energy that we put in. So yeah, it will be the same. That's why the kind of whole sector coupling thing, I think, is so important for hydrogen, because if you just look at individual usages, if you just look at like a round trip of renewable electricity to hydrogen to ammonia to hydrogen back to renewable electricity, you end up with a horrible round trip efficiency. I mean, like, in that sense, that's probably like 10% or something. But if you start to use, if you can tie it in with other things, and then, as I say, particularly things like heat, or even, as I say, not even bother with the round trip, go renewable electricity to ammonia, and then just use ammonia to replace fossil generated ammonia, then you're in a kind of different, you're into a kind of different set of economics, really.
So one thing that jumps out from your analysis there is some kind of merchant model, if you like, and a merchant model almost like integrated with a kind of a cluster. So you might say, well, you've got a cluster of a certain size. We've got 30 industries here. You've got so many need heat, so many need power, so much fuel of different types. Shouldn't we not be thinking about siting the plant within that cluster? And perhaps they are. I've not come across anybody doing any detailed analysis of where, if ammonia was to take off, and if it's to be coupled with hydrogen, would you expect some of the clusters then suddenly to start getting rejigged a little bit, and there'll be an ammonia? You said it needs a lot of heat already. Can we expect ammonia to be integrated into the 8 UK clusters, for example?
Yeah, I think it's heat is released when you're producing it, and I think you need heat input to then crack it back out again into nitrogen and hydrogen. I think on any scale, I think ultimately it would have to be tied in with industrial clusters. Obviously, in the short run, the problem you have is the usual chicken and egg thing, that if it's only on a very small scale, then it's not of sufficient interest. You can't really then cluster it into kind of a lot of different kind of applications. But then how do you get to scale to do that if you can't? So it's kind of who's going to make that leap in terms of doing a big scale clustered project? Or is it something, and if not, how do you grow it kind of organically? It's the classic kind of, if you're small, how do you have a big enough market to make it worth going bigger? It's that kind of, how to break out of that, I think, is going to be a key.
We face the same in wind, of course. It was a boutique market, and everybody laughed, and everybody kicked the metaphorical sand in our face and said why it wouldn't work, and lo and behold, it has.
But I think the difference here is you've got to tie up with wind. It was kind of, you produce electricity and you need an electricity buyer, but here you're trying to tie up lots of different things. You might be having to tie up a hydrogen production, renewable electricity, a cement works, a steel plant, a gas pipeline, whatever. There's a whole, the whole kind of industrial cluster thing is a much more kind of integrated thing.
A lot of stakeholders and a lot of different interests and a lot of people that are not necessarily bought into the concept of net zero. They might have to go for it. Do you know how much heat is needed to go through the two processes? Are we talking blast furnace levels of heat, or are we talking something?
Not off the top of my head. No, I'd have to go and look that up. It's significant. I mean, again, in terms of energy efficiency, which to some extent is looking at heat. I mean, it's something like, I think it's kind of 25% at each end in terms of energy efficiency, in terms of from what you put into what you get out in the ammonia, the energy content that you're carrying. So there's reasonably high losses.
Yeah. So if you were to look at it from just a technology point of view, you'd say, well, that's going to go nowhere. But as we know from other industries, that's not necessarily, if we can make that peck away at those losses. Are there any innovations that could help those reduce those? Or is that some formula that kind of dictates this is the equivalent of the Betts law or something like that says that's the maximum that you can get out of this technique?
I think the process for producing hydrogen and producing ammonia from hydrogen and nitrogen is the thing called the Haber-Bosch. I mean, that's Haber-Bosch process. I mean, that's been around for, I don't know, a century or so, hasn't it? I think that's pretty optimized.
What does that say?
Sorry?
What does the Haber-Bosch process tell us?
Well, so that's nitrogen and hydrogen to ammonia. That's basically how you produce ammonia currently. So I doubt whether there's much optimization to go on there. The only thing we're talking about is replacing the hydrogen with green hydrogen rather than gas produced hydrogen, so to clean up the process. So there's probably not, I don't think there's much you can do there. As I say, I think to make the economics work, it's going to be much more around, okay, if that's generating lots of heat, have we got an offtaker for that heat? And equal at the other end, if we wanted to crack ammonia, do the process in reverse and split out nitrogen and hydrogen from ammonia, We need a heat input. Have we got someone that's producing waste heat that we can, so instead of having to produce that heat ourselves, we can get some waste heat and put that into the process? Because then, again, that means the from an energy efficiency point of view, you're much better off. And also it means from a cost point of view, if you've not got to buy a source of heat to split the ammonia because you've got waste heat, then the economics improve as well. So I think that's the key. It's having, I think that's why the industrial clustering thing becomes so important, but potentially tricky to line up, because you've got to have it there. To do a project, you've got to kind of line up several things at once. So, but that, I think that's, with a lot of the stuff around hydrogen, the more I kind of look into it, the more you end up with tying processes in with the heat side of it becomes more and more important. And I don't mean heat as in using hydrogen for heating. I just mean the sources of heat or buyers of heat to make the actual various conversion processes more effective.
Yeah, I mean, if we talked in the past about siting strategies and where you would be smart to put a certain infrastructure, and it seems to be another argument in favour of the clustering approach. Each cluster, I suppose, in the UK is slightly different. They've always got different incumbents, if you like, but they do have a shared, they've all got wide range of industries, a wide range of power users, and then you tweak the offer to each individual cluster and say, we're going to need this. And I've even come across one slightly bizarrely, certainly at Teesside, looking at gas peaker plants as part of the cluster, which I thought would have been the first thing to have been shown the door, given the fact that we've got some of the offshore wind coming about 20 miles down the coast. But that's up to Teesside to work out the elements of it. But heat, we've talked about renewable heat in separate podcasts, and it's one that I think the hydrogen market is looking at. The ammonia side of things, it needs two lots of heat from what you're saying. It needs one at the production end and one at what they call the de-cracking end. So two lots, one on each end of the process.
Well, I'd have to check my chemistry, but I think at the production end, it actually is a net producer of heat. So ideally it wants someone that can take that heat. It would want a heat off-taker. And then to get the hydrogen back out of the ammonia, the other end is where you need an input of heat. That's okay. My understanding. So you'd have to sort of produce your own heat, or again, ideally, you'd have a waste source of heat that you could use into that process. So,
okay. And the big industries that use heat, I would have thought would be steel, perhaps cement. You mentioned some of the other ones in your earlier list.
Yeah, I mean, lots of kind of manufacturing, food processing. I mean, there's all sorts of industrial heat users. So yeah, but I'd have to. I can't claim to be a chemist expert in those kind of things. I'd have to look into more detail, but as a general point, if you're kind of looking at, okay, well, how do we overcome some of the objections to when people just mention efficiency? One of the ways to overcome objections often when you're looking at efficiency, as it was with power generation, is to not just think of heat as kind of something completely just a kind of annoyance or a kind of waste from the process, but use it as, okay, it's energy. Can we use it either as an energy output? Can we sell it as an energy output? Or if it's an energy input, do we have to buy it, or is there waste heat floating around somewhere that we can use?
Now, thinking of, I think you mentioned nitrogen earlier in the thing. That I take it is used as a fertilizer for fields and crops and things like that. So there's a ready market in the agricultural sector for nitrogen. Is that accurate?
Well, I mean, nitrogen is what ammonia is, NH3. So nitrogen is one of the things along with hydrogen that goes into making ammonia. And then I think it's, from ammonia, that then is a feedstock into fertilizer. I'm not entirely sure what the chemical structure of fertilizer, the chemical sort of the different chemical types of fertilizer are, but I think ammonia is a kind of preemptor for generating fertilizers and so on.
Yeah, but if you were to say, well, look, you know, to get to net zero 2050, it's only 30 years away, some places are much in advance of that as well, you're going to have to get every sector, the hard to reach sectors, I was involved in various schemes. I think about 10, 15 years ago, we were told that every farm in the UK is effectively going to become a generator. You can expect a smaller scale wind turbines to be deployed on just, there might be 10,000 farms. They might each have a, you know, a couple of megawatts wind turbine on them. That's not quite come to fruition. I think the planning regime changed. Other things happened. There was a bit of an economic downturn as well. So that has not really happened for the UK agricultural sector. Bits of AD, some of the farms have got wind turbines, but not, I would imagine, 10,000. But would this mechanism of hydrogen, nitrogen, ammonia allow a hard-to-reach sector to decarbonize? Is that an argument that could gain traction?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the argument for decarbonizing ammonia production, because then if you decarbonize ammonia production, then further along the supply chain, you're effectively decarbonizing a big chunk of agricultural emissions as well. So yeah, it's kind of, it's further down the kind of ammonia supply chain in that sense.
It's not, I mean, obviously UK is a strong agricultural entity. There are others in Europe as well and beyond. So if you're thinking globally, then you could present, you might say, well, look, the initial efficiencies are poor, but the wider sector coupling, the wider ability to reach hard to reach sectors, the wider approach to meeting net zero by 2050 might well contain an element for hydrogen, ammonia, nitrogen, agriculture. So there is something to go at, if you like, from an investor point of view.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely the reason why I think ammonia as a way of transporting hydrogen then and turning it back to hydrogen might have interest further down the line if we do need to move big amounts over big distances to turn back into hydrogen. But in the immediate term, decarbonizing ammonia is an obvious use for clean hydrogen. I mean, there's a massive market for it, we know. There's ammonia is nitrogen and hydrogen. There's nothing, we don't have to worry about nitrogen, that's floating around in the air. So if we want to decarbonize ammonia, then it's the hydrogen we have to decarbonize. So clean hydrogen, for me, one of the obvious things to do with clean hydrogen in the short and medium term is to just get on and decarbonize industries that already use fossil hydrogen. So refining would be one of those, and we see quite a few refinery projects, and then ammonia production is obviously the other one. So yeah, I mean, producing clean ammonia from clean hydrogen to me makes an awful lot of sense. Now, as you say, what it's probably going to need to get it going, as well as cost reductions on the hydrogen side, is also some additional value on clean ammonia, or some additional penalty on dirty ammonia, which basically comes back to policy and carbon prices and so on.
Yeah. So obviously, coming back to one that I'm reasonably close to, the Northwest Hydrogen Cluster, and I think there is, lo and behold, an ammonia element to that, and I think it does come from the production of ammonia. And I would have thought that if you are looking for front runners or low-hanging fruit, so to speak, you would be smart to look at that as one that might, because it contains that element, be a good one to go for quickly, rather than wait for 10 years if you're going to reach net zero. You might see some movement. I suspect in the background you're also right. I think there's lobbying under discreet lobbying. It's not necessarily plastered all over the internet, but the discussions are being had and saying, look, we're already doing this, and there's a quick win here, a relatively quick win. If you are to scale up quickly, you need projects exactly this scale. But perhaps in the longer run, there's certainly something more circular in that there's the second strand to the ammonia thing, which I'm hinting at today. Well, we know about it, but it's the case of the business case at the moment isn't quite there. But let's think for example, the Dutch hydrogen strategy, a very pragmatic one. Let's get number one in place, phase one. Once we've done that, let's have a look. Has it worked? Check. If it has, lo and behold, we've gone to phase two. We could even say that it's the same with Hydeploy in the UK. Phase one at perhaps Kiel, phase two Wind Latin. And now when you check that, well, perhaps three, a local cluster, and perhaps four, national rollout, and perhaps a similarly pragmatic, cautious, step by step. So you've got the end vision right from the start, but you've not gone rushing towards it. You've not just done everything at it, because that's not the way that major projects work. You've got to check it works, that it's safe, that it's done what it says it's going to do. And ammonia might be a front runner to enable that. If you were to pick out certain ones where you would focus attention on, we've mentioned the steel and cement, shipping, transport, ports, but you might put ammonia in that front runner bracket as well.
Yeah, I mean, some other kind of there's some other uses of ammonia, not as a fuel in effect, which have gained a bit of attention. So, I mean, you mentioned shipping there, for example. One, I know the, I can't remember which company it is. I think there's more than one actually. Big shipping companies have announced some projects to test ammonia actually as a fuel. I think you can get fuel cells that run on ammonia rather than hydrogen. And I think you can put ammonia into, I think you can put it into combustion engines. I mean, obviously not, you wouldn't put it in your car, but modified combustion engine. So there are ways to use ammonia as a power source, a propulsion source in itself. So again, that's not using ammonia as like you produce hydrogen and produce ammonia, then turn it back to hydrogen, but that's producing clean hydrogen, so you've got clean ammonia, and then using ammonia as the end use product, in this case as a fuel. I think it was Maersk
of course, bunker fuel and shipping. I mean, shipping is another sector that's quite hard
and again, it's because of then it makes sense, particularly on big long distance voyages, because as a fuel, as a clean fuel, it's obviously more energy dense than trying to use hydrogen as a fuel, and it's not got and it's potentially less costly than trying to go through the kind of synthetic fuels, so producing hydrogen and then producing kind of synthetic diesel or synthetic shipping fuel that way. So that's certainly something that's being trialed and people are playing around with. I mean, I think people have even thought about ammonia as into a fuel cell in kind of heavy vehicles and so on, but I don't think that's gone anywhere because I think it's just been kind of superseded by other things. But ammonia as a fuel is certainly something that's been.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of big vessels around there. You mentioned, I think, Maersk, and if you have to look at a company like Shell, which we speak about a lot in these podcasts, with their Stasco entity, which is the Shell trading and shipping company, there's any number of tankers and vessels around there, and they might present some opportunity. Given the fact that they're not short of ambition. Crosswind last week contained all kinds of elements, including floating solar was in there. I think there were battery elements to it. I didn't pick up on an ammonia element to it, but when you are thinking in these integrated vertical terms, you might say, well, let's have a look at our own fleet and how we go about. We've talked about decarbonizing oil and gas, haven't we, in a separate podcast, but let's have a look at the wider estate and see where the opportunity is. And obviously we do it in that step-by-step approach, go for the low-hanging fruit, go for something that can be tested, and then onto stage two, if you like, and then see how it goes.
Yeah, so shipping would be worth keeping an eye on in terms of ammonia. Again, I guess because they had a the International Maritime Organization or whatever.
Yeah.
I think they came up with some commitment to cut shipping emissions by some percentage by 2050. And so there's definitely movement in that sector.
Yeah.
And as I say, I think they looked at using hydrogen directly. But that's where the energy density thing comes in, because if your fuel takes up a big chunk of space, then that's less cargo you can transport. So I think one of the advantages of ammonia was less fuel space, more cargo space. And then I think also they were looking at the cost of producing ammonia compared to the cost of producing one of these more complicated kind of syn fuels, direct sort of drop in hydrocarbon replacement fuel. So yeah, there's interest in that. I mean, I'm guessing with shipping, the kind of rate of change, I'm guessing, is probably reasonably long. It's probably not something where next year suddenly the shipping industry will sort of transfers over to a new fuel like ammonia as an example, but certainly it's something that's being tested. I think there are various projects kind of in development for kind of the next sort of 2, 3, 4, 5 years sort of at least try it out and see how well it works.
Yeah, I mean, the British Navy did transition across from coal to oil at some stage, and that wasn't done overnight, but it was indeed transformational. Thinking again about not wanting to miss the obvious in this discussion, what about the chemical industry itself? Has that signed up to all the things that everybody else has signed? Is that showing similar dynamism in the route to net zero? Is it connected with the renewables world, or is it hoping from some other source that's going to help it get to net zero?
Well, I mean, the chemical, I mean, it covers so many, so many different things. I mean, so there are big companies doing certain processes, I think, that are very much signed up to more sustainable approaches. I mean, there are some aspects of chemical industry where they're producing, I know, chemicals for beauty products and so on, where already they can command a slightly higher fee for things if they're sustainable. So there's a kind of market for them anyway. I mean, in terms of kind of just bulk chemicals, again, we're kind of back into this issue that if it's cheaper to do something, produce something using fossil fuels and just emit, then on a big scale, you're unlikely to suddenly get people changing to do it in a clean manner. So we're back to kind of policy really there. But I think in that sense, I would say, as a general rule, maybe we'll get lots of chemical industry people phoning in and disagreeing, but as a general rule, if something's going to be more expensive to do, then on a big scale, it's not going to get done because it's a very competitive industry. And also it's a global industry. So, for example, if you're a European chemical manufacturer, why would you use clean hydrogen or clean ammonia or whatever else as a feedstock into your process if the Chinese or somebody else is using cheap, dirty fossil hydrogen or ammonia, and hence the chemicals they produce are much more competitive and they dominate the market.
If your country signed up to net zero by 2050, and we might have a bit of a carrot, but it might also be a bit of a stick and say, look, you know, we've not really focused on certain sectors in the UK. You might look at the government sector itself. Mm. You might look at the NHS. You might look at public sector. Who knows? The army. Who knows what sectors have to be an extent untouched to an extent by the net zero agenda to date. But we've only got 30 years to get there from pretty much a standing start from what we're saying in certain industries. Can you expect then pressure to start being exerted? But that's perhaps a discussion for another day rather than...
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenging one because I mean, that's back to the competitiveness argument. The danger is if you impose something unilaterally that only applies to companies operating from your country, they just move somewhere else. So that's the danger, is if the UK unilaterally has a carbon tax on chemicals produced in the UK, for example, INEOS or whoever else, why would they stay in the UK and just go somewhere else where it's cheaper to operate? And then the UK's emissions might look better, but the global emissions don't, and also you lose lots of jobs and income and so on. I mean, I think one of the things the EU, an idea that's floated around recently, is the idea of a border carbon tax.
Yeah.
So the idea that imports into the EU, there would be, I don't know exactly how they were going to work it, but it was something to take account of that, to make sure that you couldn't produce something overseas in a kind of dirty way and just import it at low cost into the EU. There would be the emissions on your production, even if it was elsewhere, would be counted somehow to put an extra charge on that. And that's about, again, this avoiding this kind of competitive difference between clean production and non-clean production somewhere else.
Okay, well, we've discussed an awful lot of detail today on ammonia and hydrogen, and to a lesser extent nitrogen and chemicals as well. And if I was to try and summarise what we've said, I think we've said that, you'd be looking initially to integrate the cleanup of the ammonia process itself. There are some big players already in that field. But beyond that, perhaps there's a second opportunity as well, where it could be looked at for shipping fuel and fuel elsewhere. And even if it's inefficient, there might be good reason why you want to explore those processes and see whether you could add a business case and a longer-term business value, especially with some of the bigger picture stuff being discussed in the various hydrogen strategies at the moment. Is there anything else that we should be adding that we've not discussed on ammonia and hydrogen in this podcast? A very detailed podcast today.
Off the top of my head, I think we've given a reasonable review of it. As I say, I mean, I suppose if I was to, along the lines of what you just said, if to prioritise, I would say prioritise cleaning up ammonia production itself would probably be the first thing. And then, as I say, maybe ammonia as a fuel. So again, one way, hydrogen to ammonia, and then ammonia directly as a fuel in applications where other things are harder to do. So shipping would be an obvious one. And then, but then the idea of hydrogen to ammonia, then back to hydrogen again. To me, there's less obvious business cases for that in any kind of foreseeable short term. So, but yeah, I mean, further down that the line, who knows? We'll see. See, that will very much depend on how much hydrogen we need. We actually find we need to start moving around over long distances on boats, ultimately. So that's further away and kind of dependent on how the whole hydrogen picture develops internationally, I would say.
Yeah, and I think, again, I think thanks for that. And I suppose we thank our listeners for listening and engaging with us. John and I, since the start of the year, have opened up the microphones to an extent. We've had a number of guest speakers. If you'd like to perhaps chat with us about an energy-related matter, if you think it would be of interest to our listeners, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you. John, is there anything else you'd like to say before we close down and thank our listeners once more for listening today?
No, I think that's good for today. Yeah, and a new topic, one we've not covered before. So, always open to ideas for new topics. And yeah, as I say, we'll hopefully mix in with a guest speaker on one of the forthcoming ones as well. But yeah, for today, yeah, ta-ra from me.
And me too. Thanks very much indeed.
Okay, thanks for listening.